Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. To call Quincy Jones a legend may be an understatement. The man has literally done it all. He's partnered and arranged music and produced music for some of the biggest artists in the world, such as Duke Ellington, several members of the Rat Pack, Michael Jackson, and more. But he's also worked across the media landscape, working on several movie scores and soundtracks, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and helping to bring that to life, Vibe Magazine, and even more recently with an NFT company. He's kept his pulse in music and entertainment, and he's one of those true one-of-ones where it's hard to think about what the landscape would look like without his influence. And this is going to be the start of a series that we're kicking off with my guy, friend of the pod, Zach O'Malley-Greenberg. We're breaking down some of the most influential moguls and legends that shaped music, media, and entertainment, talked about their backstories. Really hope you enjoy this one, so let's dive in. All right, we're here to talk about the life of the brilliant and wild Quincy Jones with Zach O'Malley-Greenberg, friend of the pod. Welcome back. What a fascinating person. I'm excited to dive into this one.
Absolutely. We've done a lot of talks about various influential companies and startups in the music and entertainment space. But when you go directly through some of the key individuals, the stories that you get out of it are almost more interesting and more instructive, more colorful, and certainly none better than Quincy Jones. So excited to dive in with you.
In any of the interviews that we've seen from Quincy Jones over the years, he has never been shy to say some things that make you raise your eyebrows. And you have firsthand experience with this because you've interviewed him before.
Yeah, I interviewed him, I think it was back in 2015 at a music conference in LA. And I was working for Forbes at the time. I had written a book called Michael Jackson, Inc. the year before that. And I remember it was a strange situation because I don't know if he knew that he was going to be interviewed. So they just plopped me with him when his car arrived. And the interview was basically walking with him to the green room to speak at the summit and then hanging out with him in the green room for a little while. He was in his early 80s and he was saying some kind of wacky stuff, no holds barred and all that. And I guess what I realized above all about Quincy, and we'll dig into this a little bit more, he's been saying wacky stuff all his life. And I remember when I was talking to him, he would go off on these tangents. And just when you thought you were losing him, he would come back with these gems of quotes. He said, music. He said, you can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't smell it. But Lord knows you can feel it. He said, just do something you love. It gives you goosebumps. And I think one of the things we were really focused on at that time was EDM. And in fact, that was what the conference was about. And I asked him what he thought about EDM and if it was a fad or not. And he said, it's a fad right now, but if they handle it, it won't be a fad. And I think that was a really prescient quote. And I think we don't really refer to EDM as much with that term as we used to about a decade ago when you're starting to see all these DJs get residences in Las Vegas. And he was right. Obviously, you can't have something that hot be that hot for forever, but in any case, I think he was right. Kind of a strange place to start, perhaps, but that was my experience with him, and I think it really gives a flavor of the man behind the music.
That insight, though, of seeing a new genre, getting his take, times where he was at the forefront of particular genres and people had pushback on him, became a central theme. So this is someone that initially grew up, born and raised in Chicago, Great Depression era. He's born in 1933. His family moves up to Chicago as part of the Great Migration. And this is poverty, don't have a lot of money. But that struggle, that experience does set the foundation for how he views things and how he ultimately wants to progress and live his life.
Yeah. And one of the things I didn't really know until I started digging into the research for this episode was the lineage in his family. So his paternal grandma was a former slave, and then he was also a distant relative of George Washington. And then he had French Huguenot heritage as well. And so he's really was a child of many different backgrounds that all came together in his life and his work.
He had done one of those 23andMe or Ancestry.com. It said that he was 34% European. So that lines up exactly with that. For him, early on, it was the piano and the trumpet. He was breaking into places to try to get a feel for it. His mother was involved with music. He stayed in Chicago for a little bit. His family eventually moves to Seattle. But by the time he's a teenager, he's already leaning in fully into music. And that's where we're already seeing him at an early age starting to take risks. I was thinking about the things that I was doing at 17 years old and then reading about the things that Quincy Jones was doing at 17 years old. That's why this person is a savant. Even though he had different roles, there was always a through line with everything that he did for 70 plus years of his career in music.
Yeah, and even earlier than 17, I think he was in his early to mid-teen years when he met Ray Charles in Seattle and started to trade musical ideas with him and have that diffusion happen. Into his early 20s, he was playing backup for Elvis shortly thereafter, doing commissions for jazz legends in New York. He had this wild experience moving around the country as a kid. He's probably lived in California for half a century at this point, but I think having Chicago and Seattle and New York and Boston all kind of mixed together also really informed his sort of eclectic conception of music.
Right, because the New York time, that's when things really leaned in. He started doing freelance arrangements, as we talked about Ray Charles, but also Duke Ellington, also Diana Washington. An arranger isn't the type of role that you hear a lot about in music today. The role is blended into several other things, but this was one of the things that he was skillful at, and that really requires a few things. One, you need to have some musicality to understand what works and what doesn't and how to click things together. But you also need to have relationships. You also need to have influence to be able to work with a Duke Ellington, work with an Elvis, work with a Ray Charles, work with Diana Washington, the Rat Pack as well. You need to be able to have that wide range. That stuff really worked in his favor.
Yeah. When you're arranging music, part of the goal is to make whoever you're arranging it for sound like the best version of themselves. That's something that he did perhaps better than anybody, especially as his career went on. It wasn't like he was only able to make pop stars sound like their best version of their pop selves. We're talking jazz and pop and everything in between. One of the things he said to me when I was interviewing him, there are only so many notes. They're not inventing new notes. How do you rearrange the notes that do exist in a novel way, in an interesting way, and in a way that makes whoever you're arranging them for sound like their best self?
And when you listen to the music that he released himself, you see a lot of that through line. He's the front man for this jazz band. This is how I feel about jazz. That was the first album. He moves to Paris to continue to study music. He was a musical director for this French distributor, Barclay Disc. He's touring North America. He's touring Europe. And one of the groups that he was part of, the Jones Boys, there was 18 of them. He was also the front man there. But he also saw some early challenges there too. Quincy had contemplated suicide at one particular point. That's when things really started to shift for him, where he says, okay, what's the next thing? And then that's when he ends up landing his first job working in the major record label system as an A&R at Mercury Records.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember what the music business was like back then. There was all kinds of mafia involvement. There's payola. There's still some shady things that happen in the music business. But it was more explicitly shady in mid-century America. One of the things that you learn in that environment is how to survive in extreme circumstances and how to think on your feet. It's not just the creative side of things. It's the moving and the shaking and the horse trading that definitely was what got added to his resume when he joined at Mercury in the early 60s.
It's also interesting timing because this is the decade when Berry Gordy is making things happen. So the 60s are a very influential time for black music. But you'll start to see some interesting things that Quincy starts to do as well. He starts releasing music himself as part of Mercury Records. He has the popular song, the big band Bossa Nova, where they use that sample in Austin Powers. Ludacris had it in one of his songs off of the Red Light District album. This experience was a bit of a centering where, okay, you did a lot of stuff in music to get to this point, which is great. Quincy's in his early 30s, mid-30s. We start to see him get involved with multimedia and starting to do different scores for different movies and TV shows as well. That became a through line for him too.
Yeah, it shouldn't be understated. There weren't black executives at quote-unquote major record labels in those days. And for Quincy to be adjusting to this new world, this very shady, cutthroat world, and also breaking that barrier and dealing with everything that must have come along with it in terms of prejudice and so forth, it's all the more remarkable.
He was also lining up with other people that were trailblazing things. A lot of the movies that he did scores for were Sidney Poitier movies. He was the first black man to win Best Actor at the Academy Awards. Quincy also was the first black person to win Grammys for many of the major categories that he was able to. I wanted to talk a little bit about his X factor. What are some other things that we think helped him stand out? Because this is clearly a one of one. He has the musical ear, he has the influence, but what are those other things? Like when we're talking about the stories and being able to dive deep into what set this person apart.
Maybe this is a corny or obvious thing to say, but Quincy's cool. Quincy is really cool. And it is hard to like fully describe that. But you meet this guy, even in his later years, he's super charismatic. He's magnetic. He really pulls people together. He's got lead singer energy, even though he's behind the scenes more as a producer and as an executive. He certainly has the personality and that magnetic quality that you can't teach, even behind the scenes, that can be really important.
Lead singer energy, main character energy, that's a good way to put it. And it's a bit unique too, because so many of the other people that have been in his type of role that have had that lead energy, they often try to insert themselves in so many different areas of the actual product itself, whether Dame Dash, we've talked about him. We did our Rockefeller episode. He definitely has main character energy. He was in all the music videos. Puff, he was as well. We can go down the list. He knew his spot, but he was still able to command that influence and command that presence. That is a unique thing because so many of those other people want to be all in the video.
Right, absolutely. It's not like he's a retiring person like Dr. Dre. And obviously Dr. Dre is in his own music videos and other people's. Too, you can tell that he's a little bit uncomfortable with the spotlight, and Quincy isn't uncomfortable with the spotlight. And he just, like you say, he picks his spots. He knows what he's best at, and he's not moonwalking in Michael Jackson's videos or ad-libbing in some intrusive way. He lets the brilliance breathe in other artists and doesn't need to be the center of attention, even though he's super magnetic.
We should talk about a few things in the 70s, though. So one, this is where Quincy's health first has a concern. So at this point, he's in his 40s and he has a brain aneurysm. For a man in his early 40s, pretty young to have that type of experience. And a lot of the reports were that, hey, this is a very slim chance of surviving, but he's able to continue on and not necessarily slow down. He's able to continue pushing on with his work. And then too, we also see him start to forge that relationship with Michael Jackson. And this is probably one of the more storied relationships that we've seen. But before we dive into that, though, we should probably just talk about where Michael Jackson was at this time, because he was working with Berry Gordy, with Motown. And we talked about that in the Motown episode, but worth just recapping a little bit of it here. In the 70s, Michael Jackson, then we clearly see he is breaking out. He's in The Wiz, and that's how they first start their friendship, Quincy and Michael specifically. But we'll start to see that Michael clearly had some challenges navigating the Berry Gordy relationship, both as it came to royalties, but also as it came to him not necessarily being able to blossom the way that he did. And Quincy had this interesting quote where he said, "Before Michael was working with me, he was in movies like Ben singing about a rat." We're the ones that really made him a star. It's a good opportunity to just talk about Berry Gordy and Quincy and how they worked and operated and how that worked with Michael, because Berry Gordy was a engineer through and through. It was the Ford Model T line approach. He worked on a car plant himself and adapted that same mentality. And a lot of the 20th century growth and progress was because a lot of factories, a lot of businesses adopted what Henry Ford was able to create and they became more efficient. He applied that to music. The strength of that is that you can create the powerhouse of having different artists do different versions of Ain't No Mountain High or whatever the hit is and just cranking that out. The challenge, though, is that when you have someone that has the talent and the ability of Michael, you're restricting them if you're trying to A, control their creative vision, and B, cut off their income because you're trying to leave them with some paltry royalty cut from it. Quincy, different, where obviously he's not the record label owner, However, he's able to blend in these different sounds from funk and soul and jazz and rock, and that together combined with the package of Michael Jackson becomes the sound that we see. And I think that's the difference between the two people like that. Gordy is someone that's a bit more of an engineer versus Quincy is that true artistic savant that was able to help elevate.
Yeah. And Berry Gordy, and was he a musical genius? Sure. But above all, he was a business genius. And like you say, it's that assembly line mentality. And when you look at the amount of recording, the amount of work that the Jackson 5 were doing in the early 70s, people forget. If you look at their discography, they put out their first album at the end of 1969, the first album on Motown. And then in 1970, they released three albums. That's insane. They released three albums and then an album every year and sometimes multiple albums a year, basically until the end of the 70s. And on top of it, they had Michael Jackson doing solo stuff, and Jermaine eventually did solo stuff. But like even before, people think, oh, you know, Off the Wall was really when Michael did his first solo album. That's not true. He did four solo albums on Motown, and like the Quincy quote goes, it was like Michael singing about a rat, and they did fine. But with the Berry Gordy Motown model, it was, there's a formula for the song. You have a verse, you have a chorus, you have a verse, you have a chorus, you have a bridge, you have a chorus, you have an outro, and you yell the name of the song at the end of the song. I want you back! That's so people can hear it on the radio and go buy the record. And that was that. And that formula worked really well. And especially with really talented kids who just wanted to make records and do the thing. But when you start to get older, you start to have more artistic ideas and you want to break out of a cookie cutter mold, even though it's going really well. And of course, Michael being Michael and with all his musical brilliance, he really wanted to try some other things. And that's what kind of led to him getting some wanderlust. To your point, very different philosophy between Quincy and Berry.
The way that Berry Gordy ran it, it was like a Mickey Mouse Club. You had this set type of product to create, but at a certain level, you don't know if Ryan Gosling can't become an A-list actor unless he gets out of that system and does his own thing. Justin Timberlake can't become a successful artist until he breaks out of that and does his own thing. So you need to have the people to branch out. And I think for Quincy and Michael, it really was perfect timing for both of them, right? Off the Wall comes out, and after the success and the hit of that album, Quincy becomes the most sought after producers in the entire world. He is the guy after that.
Yeah, and Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, an iconic beginning. That was very different from what Michael had been doing before. That was a 6-minute long song. That was a lot of Quincy in there. There was a New York Times interview about a decade ago where they said, could Michael have done it without you? And Quincy was, you've listened to this stuff, what do you think? And which could be interpreted one way, but then he says, no, it's just the union of two people coming together and creating something that neither of them could have created on their own. He brought in Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder and some other folks to help write some of the songs. That's not necessarily something Berry Gordy would have done. I think maybe part of it is because it would have been really expensive, and Berry Gordy was like so efficient about everything. Off the Wall was more or less a disco record. We can debate it, but it was heavily disco. And maybe you want to say it wasn't disco, but you can't argue. It was heavily influenced by disco, which is a big departure from Michael's previous stuff. Off the Wall blew everybody's expectations, blew the doors off of everybody's expectations, selling 25 million copies. It was the best-selling album by a black artist to that point. But MJ stayed home from the Grammys that year because he did get nominated in the main categories. And he actually thought of it as a failure because he basically wanted Off the Wall to be what Thriller was in terms of critical reception. And so with Thriller, again, speaking to Quincy's versatility, what a totally different ballgame from Off the Wall, which was a different ballgame from what MJ had been doing before. Bringing in Eddie Van Halen, Paul McCartney again was on there, Steve Picaro from Toto, so that there was a great diversity of collaborators.
That is the magic of Quincy Jones. And it was interesting to see how their creative relationship continued with Thriller, because that's an album where the music videos became even more of the core product that helped the release of this album. There was a very challenging history with the early days of MTV with regards to black artists and getting a platform there, but the timing worked out with Michael and being able to have the release of the video be this event itself on MTV. And Quincy wasn't as much involved with the music videos. A lot of that leans in Michael and him wanting to make sure that it was this larger than life event as possible. But Quincy was still instrumental in the audio remixing and making sure those albums had the beat that was their apex. As Michael's career started to rise and he started to gain more control, more confidence, you started to see that tension come out around the time of Bad's release in 1987. Then it becomes one of these inevitable things where who feels like one is taking more credit, who feels like one has more control over the project. And Bad still had big hits, still had a music video that was directed by Martin Scorsese. There was still a lot of meat on the bone there.
Yeah, this is a story I got from Walter Yetnikoff when I was writing my book about Michael Jackson. He told me Michael called him the night before the Grammys, the Thriller Grammy year that Michael won all those. Michael calls Walter Yetnikoff, who's then the head of CBS Records, and he's basically, Walter, you've got to get them to take Quincy off of these Grammys that I'm going to inevitably win. Like, it's my album. And Walter's, dude, I can't do that. Oh, it's like the ceremony's tomorrow. And even if it weren't, like, I couldn't. He's your collaborator. Come on. I was in the room. Like, you guys did this together. And Michael grumbles and whatever. Off he goes. And he wins all these awards. And Quincy is there. And they're all happy. And there are all these photos of them together looking happy. But, right, like, Michael, I think, wanted more of the credit, and he was worried that Quincy was going to get too much of the credit for being there and up on the stage with him and all these awards. They probably both felt like they didn't get quite enough credit, because on the one hand, you're MJ, you're like, I'm the artist, I'm the one singing, I'm the one that people are fainting and swooning over, and it's my face on the record. And of course, Quincy's, before you teamed up with me, you were just singing about rats. There's a point to both of them, but I think it does come down to that alchemy when you put two elements together and you create something that's greater than the sum of the parts, and that's really what they had.
Let's take a break for our Chartmetric stat of the week. The Quincy Jones Michael Jackson partnership has been one of the most talked about for years, and the Michael Jackson catalog is often believed to be one of the most valuable of all time. And that's because of the lasting appeal, especially for these albums that Quincy and Michael worked on together. According to Chartmetric's tracking, Michael's music is currently on over 1.2 million Spotify playlists. Let's get back to the episode.
And their partnership. And I think Bad, that was when people started really noticing Michael's appearance changing, and his nose looked different and his skin was whiter, and people were beginning to really speculate about that. Apparently Bad was originally envisioned as a duet sort of dance-off between MJ and Prince. And they brought Prince into the studio to meet and talk it over. And Michael had said something like, I write down all my good ideas, because if I didn't, God would give them to Prince. So he was very competitive with him. But anyway, Prince comes in to meet with Michael to talk about this duet dance off, whatever. And apparently brings him a voodoo amulet. And this just like freaks Michael out so much. He's, I don't ever want to work with that guy. That is too freaky for me. And it didn't happen. Who knows if that's why the duet didn't go down, but that would have been a pretty fascinating thing for Quincy to have orchestrated.
Wild, wild. I have a question that I'm going to pose here. So the most influential producer and artist partnerships of all time. We're going to count them down 5-1 and then talk it through. So number 5, we have Rick Rubin and Run DMC. Number 4, we have Max Martin and Taylor Swift. Number 3, we have Dr. Dre and Snoop and Eminem. It was hard to split between one of those, so we can just combine them together. And number 2, George Martin and the Beatles. And number 1, Quincy and MJ. Thoughts?
Would these artists be considered all-time great artists, or like top 5, top 10 all times if they had not had this combo? I think Taylor Swift is probably 5 with Max Martin, because certainly I think her partnership with Jack Antonoff has been at least as influential. And certainly, like, earlier in her career, she did it without Max Martin. So I would put that at 5. I'd probably say Dre with Snoop and Eminem 4, because, again, so much, like, Snoop and Eminem continue to make music on their own and have made a lot of big hits without Dre. I would actually say 50 and Dre is more... Dre is more critical to 50's success than he was to Snoop or Eminem.
That is a very hot take.
I think 50 is basically irrelevant as an artist without Dr. Dre producing. And you couldn't say that about Snoop and Eminem.
We heard Eminem Invincible before Dre came on. He needed a cosign. Yeah. And he needed a cosign from the guy.
That's true. Okay, I'll put that at 4. Rick Rubin, Run DMC, that's pretty dang influential. But I would put it at 3 simply because I think Run DMC and the Beastie Boys weren't as influential as the other two. And I would go George Martin, Beatles 2, and Quincy MJ 1, because I think Thriller was the most influential album of all time. And that was definitely like a product of that creative alchemy that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's tough. I'd probably do the ranking that I had put out there. But all these are debatable, right? That's why I like put it there. I do think that Max Martin and Taylor Swift, him working on that Red album with her was, we're no longer doing the country pop, modern Shania Twain thing. We are going for the biggest artist in the world status. We saw some of those same kind of tensions there happen too. A lot of it hasn't been stated bluntly in interviews, but there's enough people that believe that Taylor Swift had some issues about 1989 and Red being seen as these albums that Max Martin was able to help put her over the top and make her the biggest star in the world. And she stopped working with him after that, almost as a way to prove that, okay, it isn't just this man that's responsible. So the counter, though, is that she's clearly ascended to even bigger heights even after.
That would be the biggest argument against the Max Martin Taylor Swift combo.
Yeah. With like Snoop and Eminem. Eminem was the most commercially successful artist of the 2000s, an entire decade, and still has the most commercially successful song on streaming, at least from the 2000s, with Lose Yourself and a few that aren't too far behind either. But all these are debatable, right? I'm not going to knock anyone for having George Martin and the Beatles as number one, right? I think that if either one of those weren't one or two, I think it would be a bit tough. Before we move on from the 80s, though, we should also talk about We Are the World and Quincy's job arranging that, because that was this song that they created to raise awareness and raise money. And that is what we're talking about in terms of Quincy's power. They had this really interesting documentary that they put out on Netflix, The Greatest Night in Pop Music, and you have the biggest artists in the world all coming together in this room. And that's the type of thing that you can put together if you are the biggest producer in the world and everyone either wants to work with you or has some type of project in the works. That documentary is also interesting because you start to see some of these drama points play out, whether it's MJ or Prince or other people. But that's what we're talking about when we're talking about Quincy and his ability. And that's the type of thing it could be hard to replicate, but that's what you get from decades in the game and just approaching things in a different way and aligning yourself with people who can be the vehicle to put that to life.
Absolutely. And especially in an era before social media and that sort of thing, the power of a collaboration like that to call attention to a major humanitarian issue, it's hard to even fathom the impact that it had relative to everything else going on at the time. But it just speaks to Quincy's ability to bring people together and from all these different backgrounds. And when you think about the sheer quantity of A-list divas that he got in the same room, some were just basically saying backup, right? I can't even think of anything that's been done like that. There's been a few. The Sandy Relief concert in New York a decade or so ago.
Yeah, there was something about mass media and just mainstream broadcast in the 80s that allowed for that type of thing to happen and for it to have that impact. Live Aid with Queen performing there, that was around the same time frame. I remember shortly after 9/11, you had the modern version of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, when you had so many contemporary artists. I know Nelly had some verse in there, but I don't even know if all those artists were in the same room when they recorded that. Maybe they all came in and did sessions. I forget exactly how that one worked, but yeah, to your point, you don't see things like that happen. In today's media landscape, you just don't see telethon-style events like that to bring these entertainers together. And sometimes these things get mocked because they look ridiculous. When was it when at the beginning of the pandemic, when Gal Gadot and all these celebrities were taking turns singing acoustic versions of John Lennon, Imagine. And people are just like, what? This isn't what we need. What is this right now? Before we get to the next part of Quincy's work, I want to play a quick game of Quincy Jones quotes with you and play two truths and a lie. So, Zach, I am going to throw out three quotes from Quincy Jones that he's made in interviews. One of them he did not actually say. Okay. Two of them he did.
Okay.
Quote number one. Every time we'd go to Detroit at the Majestic Hotel, standing in front with his Italian shit on and amber glasses, Malcolm X, Detroit Red. That's where we bought our dope.
Okay.
Quote two. I told NBC to put Rashida Jones, my daughter, on The Office. Not a lot of people know that. That's quote two.
Okay.
And quote three. Frank Sinatra was almost trying to hook me up with Marilyn Monroe, but Marilyn Monroe had a chest that looked like pears, man. End quote.
The one that was not a quote, I'm going to go with number two.
That is correct.
In a way, it's just not outlandish enough. Do you know what I mean? Like, the outlandish quotes that he has are so outlandish that you couldn't even really make them up. Like, only he could make them up. And in fact, a lot of the time they're true. That's the thing about Quincy, especially now. It's dude is in his 90s and you hear him quoted and you might be tempted to say, oh, you know, he's losing it. He's making it up. But actually, I mean, he's been there, right? He's been there for in this just vast array of circumstances, and he has some of the wildest stories of really anybody, from Malcolm X to Marilyn Monroe to Michael Jackson, truly one of a kind.
That was good, and that's good logic, too. It's almost like a show like Veep can exist in Obama or a Bush presidency where there's enough to make fun of that doesn't seem like it's too far removed from reality, but after that, how do we make this seem more outlandish and what's actually happening? I'll have one more for you towards the end of the episode, though, so stay tuned for that. But this is probably a good opportunity to talk about some of Quincy's multimedia. We talked about the scores of different soundtracks, but then in the late 80s, he has a party at his house, and Will Smith, a rapper who was somewhat struggling and was having some commercial or financial problems at the time, but still his pure self, is at Quincy Jones's party, ends up talking to him, and Quincy realizes that he sees something in Will and has him literally audition on the spot for NBC executives there. And 3 months later, they filmed the pilot for The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and Quincy Jones is involved with one of the most commercially successful TV shows of the 90s on NBC. And he was able to have certain things about his own experience that he sees that lives through someone like Will Smith, specifically the growing up in the rough neighborhoods of West Philadelphia. Quincy saw that as a similarity to him growing up in Depression era Chicago and make it and break through and then coming to somewhere like Bel Air and that juxtaposition. This was a thing that was talked about with Quincy and Michael Jackson, where Michael Jackson felt like Quincy was leading a bit too into hip hop and thought that hip hop was going to be bigger than it was. Michael questioned whether or not it was going to be this fad, but Quincy was like, hey, there's something real here. And here he is working with a rapper, and you can see so much of the hip hop culture comes from that show. So again, tying back to something you had mentioned earlier in their episode about genres, this is where Quincy was right. It lines up with the rise in the golden era of hip-hop as well.
Yeah, and I think he had just the right eye for it. And Will Smith was a gateway drug to hip-hop for middle America. It's, oh, Will Smith. Like, he doesn't curse. He's clean cut. Ironically, years later, he's the guy who does the slap, but whatever. Quincy could see that hip-hop was here to stay. He saw Will Smith's talent, but also his ability to be a cultural emissary. And he was spot on with that. We've talked before about Will Smith and Tupac and the different sides of hip-hop that they represent. Jada being close with Tupac growing up and Will Smith feeling like he couldn't measure up to Tupac in that way. But interestingly, Tupac was engaged to Quincy's daughter, Kidada, at the time of his death. And they'd been together for many months at that point. And Tupac also had an interesting relationship with Quincy. On the one hand, he had criticized Quincy for dating white women or marrying white women. And then he started dating Quincy's daughter, and then they became friendly. And Quincy tells some story in interviews where he met Tupac for lunch somewhere, and then Tupac was like, "Oh, I got to go home and put on a tie or something." He really felt the need to impress Quincy, and he just had that aura. I also heard whispers that at some point Quincy was like advising Tupac that he ought to consider leaving Death Row and doing something else with his career and his music. Who knows? Game of Telephone through the grapevine, how true that is. But fascinating again to find. We talk about Quincy as somebody who unites people, who can bring together all kinds of different folks. Tupac and Will Smith were like oil and water, and yet Quincy ended up being relatively close to both of them.
The other big thing that Quincy Jones did in the 90s was become the co-founder of Vibe magazine. The magazine officially launches in 1993, but it was 1991 where Quincy was talking to Steve Ross, and Steve Ross was recently overseeing the merger of Warner Communications and Time Inc. The companies come together, but it's not like lightning in a bottle at first. There's some pressure. Steve Ross is starting to get some people looking at him like, all right, what did we merge this company for? And he's like, all right, I need something. And Quincy is the one that comes up with this idea to have this magazine. But his whole thing is, okay, I don't want this to just be another hip hop magazine. I want to have it be more broadly about urban culture, but I want to cover Black people. I want to cover Black stories. And we were able to have a very successful magazine that had done that. And I think one of the things that stuck out with Vibe specifically, but having a cover of a magazine obviously was just such a big and unique product and a big aspect. It was often a horse trading thing with the people that were the subject matters as well. But I do think that Vibe definitely leaned into this, especially for a newer magazine, and put so much energy into this. And you saw it with the iconic covers that you would see, whether it was the Death Row cover with the four of them. But then they had also talked about how they would have covers with Wesley Snipes that didn't sell. And then they had one with Rosie Perez that did. I think like a lot of others at the time, probably was a little bit late to the pivot to online. And there were other companies, whether it was Complex or some of the other blog era out there, that just attracted more of their audience. But it was still pretty influential. And that Vibe itself was eventually sold off in 2005 for $50 million. We don't know the exact numbers for how much Quincy had made from that, but he was involved with a pretty influential magazine that still, to this day, is still putting out online media and covering the industry, and was most recently part of the sale that has it under Penske Media from the sale that happened 4 years ago. So it's been cool to see him have his stamp there too.
Yeah, and I think people forget this guy's been alive for almost a century. He's really done it all. And again, it speaks to the creative genius, maybe more than the business genius, because like probably a business genius wouldn't have founded a magazine, not such a great business these days, but certainly at the time. And I think when at the height of Vibe, it was not only culturally relevant, but I think it was a really good business proposition as well.
Indeed. And even recently, he's had his hands in so many different things. He was one of the investors behind One Of, an NFT platform. They raised $63 million in their seed round. This was as peak COVID lockdown pandemic, zero interest rates as it gets. I think it's safe to assume someone like Quincy, even just off of the Michael music alone, is set for life and has been, but they just stay active. They stay involved with different things.
Yeah. And if we were to really do a calculation, there was a report that Quincy earned $18 million from 2019 to 2017 on MJ royalties alone. So if you want to talk about 8 years, that's a little over $2 million a year. Obviously, things go up and down. There was up a lot right after MJ died. But then maybe there's a bit of a lull, but then streaming came up. If he indeed controls all those rights, and then who knows what he still controls or in terms of the multimedia rights or what he got off of the Vibe sale or how much of the earnings from the music that he kept or what he did with it or how he invested it. But probably safe to say that just on music alone, he's a centimillionaire. And it just speaks to not only to his music genius, but also to his business savvy as well.
Yeah, this is something that's definitely, I'm sure that the estate is either set, or if he ever decides to sell at any point, I'm sure that the number would be impressive there. One more game here of two truths and a lie of Quincy Jones' statements here. Quote number one, Elon Musk keeps trying to get me to go to Burning Man. No, thank you. Quote number two, the Beatles were the worst musicians in the world. They were no playing motherfuckers. Paul was the worst bass player I ever heard. And Ringo, don't even talk about it. Quote number three, I knew Donald Trump was going to win, but you motherfuckers didn't want to listen.
I think the fake one is number one.
The fake one is number three.
Whoa! Wow! Wow, 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 wow. Okay, all right.
So according to the GQ interview that he did and the Vulture one that he did, these were two interviews that he did right around the time of that 2018 Quincy documentary that released on Netflix. Quincy had talked about his relationship with Elon Musk, how Elon Musk was a neighbor of his, and how they would catch up every once in a while.
All right. Yeah, I was between one and three, but I just thought, I don't know, something about Burning Man. In a way, the third one is like the most reasonable quote. Like, it probably easier for somebody to make up than for him to dream up. And the second one, we haven't talked about that, but that's just incredible. Yeah, one of a kind character.
His quotes and his statements about the Beatles are interesting. Something that I was going to ask you, because you've interviewed him, do you feel that Quincy Jones is a reliable narrator about his life?
I would say mostly, because some of it is verifiable, right? But then again, is there some embellishment? I don't know. One of the interesting things about writing my book about Michael Jackson was that I would compare things that Quincy said to things that Michael said and the things that Berry Gordy said about the same situation. And often you'd get three different versions of the same story. And there's really an aspect of the winner gets to write the history. But if you have a bunch of winners, they're all saying different things, then who gets to write the history? So even when you look at the genesis of their relationship, Michael and Quincy, there's some agreement that they first met when MJ was a kid and was in Vegas, and Sammy Davis Jr. introduced them or something, just in passing. But in terms of how Quincy came on to produce Off the Wall, both of them said it was the other one's idea, and they had different versions of it. And so it can't both be 100% true. Yeah, I think there's some embellishment and some poetic license that takes place, but he lived such an incredible life that stories that would seem completely insane and untrue, he's actually had occasion to experience them.
I do think that most of the things that he said is true. I think if there's question marks about what's untrue, I think there's maybe some embellishing that happens with any storytelling, but the core thing that happened is true. For instance, do I believe that he sat across from Ivanka Trump at some event and ate a meal with her? And maybe it was just them at a particular point where the other people around. It wouldn't surprise me. Close circles, different people introducing each other. Oh, look, it's Quincy Jones here. Sit down, talk to him. Yes. Do I think he dated Ivanka Trump? No. But so that's an example of a type of thing. And I think we could probably do that with a lot of quotes. But I do think that most of the stuff that he does say, remember, like this is a lot of it is wild. But we also know that the 80s were wild. The 70s were wild. We know how wild musicians and artists and all of these folks were. Like, this is someone that doesn't have any reason to hold things back, and to just call those things out of thin air would seem a little bit strange. Granted, he's had some of those same claims made about him and he's refuted them as well. But I do think that Quincy Jones is reliable, a good storyteller. And I think like a lot of storytellers can add a little of fluff to their stories for the sake of the story. But I do think that he is fairly reliable.
Yeah, fairly reliable. Kernel of truth in even the less true stories. And I think one thing that maybe he didn't do that a lot of people we've talked about have done is had a killer branded product, and you think like, that wasn't really his jam. He was this musical genius, whatever. But I was thinking about that earlier today, and I was like, wait a minute, look at these Quincy Jones reference headphones by AKG. I've had these for 10 years. How random is that? If we're sitting here like, well, he never really had his Beats by Dre moment. He did, right? He even had a headphone line, and I just didn't do quite as well as Beats by Dre. But again, you can't be a total genius and be also lucky in everything you do.
Right. The jazz band that didn't work out, clearly, and they're stranded and running out of money. He had tried to start his own record label, and it didn't take off in that same type of way, despite all the influence. So he found the lane that did work for him. So he's still able to be involved with it. But yeah, I think it really is a remarkable story of someone that was able to try a bunch of different things, have different hands in it, and found what worked for him. But before we close things out, any other thoughts on Quincy Jones?
I think we've covered just about everything. We could be here the rest of the day, but so I guess we could leave it there.
Indeed. Zach, this was a bunch of fun. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.